And now it's time to consider the Quahog. I grew up in a small town on Montreal Island. Outside my grade school, a flag flew, and it was a Union Jack. Every morning, we stood facing a portrait of Elizabeth II and sang, "God Save the Queen." This was before, I'm dating myself here, before the celebration of the 100th anniversary of Confederation, when Canada got its own flag and its own national anthem. At the time, 80% of the population of Quebec were French-speaking Catholics, 10% were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and 10% were First Nations. There wasn't much mixing. Most of the English Canadians lived on the west side of Montreal Island, and there was only one English-speaking town that was not on Montreal Island. And that was located across the river from the Mohawk Reservation at Caughnawaga. The Mohawk, as you may know or may not, I'm going to tell you, are the easternmost nation of the Haudenosaunee Confederation, whose Thanksgiving address we heard this morning. You may know the Haudenosaunee by the name the French gave them, which was the Iroquois. They lived, and they still do, in upstate New York and in southern Ontario and Quebec. Once, violence and rivalry occurred among the tribes. The peacemaker, one of the cherished teachers we heard about in the Thanksgiving address, his name was Daganaveda, and he came with Hiawentha to teach the tribes the great law of peace, how to see each other as equals, as part of the same family, how to console each other's hearts, how to come to one mind, how to establish a polity and a democracy, how to live in covenant, and how to record it all for posterity. The Haudenosaunee Confederation recorded their oral constitution through the mnemonic device of wampum strings and belts woven from purple and white shell beads. The white was the inner spirally core of the channeled whelk, and the purple beads are made from the rims of the quahog shells, the Rhode Island chowder clam. The quahog shells come from down here around Narragansett Bay, and they were essential to Haudenosaunee governance. Everything from tribal and national policy to their treaties with other tribes was symbolically recorded in these wampum strings and belts. The belts metaphorically represented a navigable river, which made sense because rivers were often the place where borders existed and resources were shared. Most of the strings and belts have visual themes of connection, such as strings in circles or belts with interlocking arms, people with interlocking arms, or interlocking territories. When the Tuscarora were admitted into the Confederation, the metaphor was that of extending the rafters of a longhouse to make more room. The founding of the Haudenosaunee Confederation is recorded in what's called the Five Nations Wampum Belt, which features a central image, and it depends which way you hold the belt, but it's either a fire or a heart. And that represents the Onondaga, who were represented in the middle. And then to the west, you had the Cayuga and the Seneca. And to the east, the Oneida and the Mohawk. And it represented the connection of those five tribes into a nation. Many attempts to date the founding of the Haudenosaunee Nation were linked to the stories of a solar eclipse, and we think that was the 1451 solar eclipse. Some people say it's 1190. But in any event, the Haudenosaunee Confederacy was well established in time before Jacques Cartier came sailing down the St. Lawrence River looking for a passage to the east. When he landed on the island now known as Montreal in 1535, he and his crew were very ill, and the Mohawk nursed the Frenchmen back to health and sent them home. However, Samuel Champlain came back in 1605, and he tried to create a fur trading post on the Montreal Island, but he was rebuffed. And he did, however, introduce the First Nations people to firearms, with the consequence that some of the people fell out of their covenant of the Great Peace. They took sides with the different groups of foreigners who were coming to look for resources. And this was considered a spiritual crime because the Creator did not intend for people to be warring. By the time the Dutch arrived down in Manhattan and began exploring the Hudson River, the Haudenosaunee had learned a lesson or two about how quickly things could accelerate. They wanted peace because of their spirituality and their culture. And the Dutch wanted peace because that's good for business. So in 1613, so that's 7 years before the Plymouth Plantation, 1613, the Haudenosaunee and the Dutch hoped that their two cultures would coexist as neighbors and trading partners. And the metaphor for this was the Dutch ship and the Haudenosaunee canoe. Each was different, with no power over the other. And the idea was that these two vessels would travel down the river of life together, side by side, always parallel, always separate, and always equal. And this was documented by something called the two-row wampum belt. And what it is, it's a big, long wampum belt, and there's two purple stripes representing the canoe and the ship, and it's on a field of white, and the three bands of the white ground represent the three great principles of the law of peace, and those are friendship, respect, and peace. The Dutch had a written document describing this, which added the metaphor of a three-link chain, fastening the ship and the canoe to the Haudenosaunee Great Tree of Peace. And both sides emphasized the need to continually reaffirm the treaty, or what came to be called polishing the chain. 7 years later, our English theological ancestors arrived in Plymouth. And when you participate in the UU Common Read, there will be a meeting about it on January 16th with Kathy, you will know that the culture of conquest was long established in Europe. The culture of conquest is what had all the naval powers of Europe looking to the Pope of Rome as a referee for their so-called discoveries in what they referred to as the New World. In the words of author Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, profit-based religion was the deadly element that European traders and settlers brought to the Americas. In addition to seeking personal wealth, the colonizers expressed a Christian zeal that justified their colonialism. Now we get to some of the hard part. As Unitarian Universalists, our shared theological ancestors include the Calvinist writers of the Mayflower Compact, who saw themselves as the elect. Our ancestors include the first Massachusetts Bay governor, John Winthrop, and you probably know his sermon, The Model of Christian Charity, that was written aboard the Arbella. And he wrote, "We must be considered as a city on a hill. The eyes of the people are upon us." They consciously saw themselves as role models. And they believed they were in a covenant with their God, who had chosen them as the chosen people. And this is something about that sermon which you probably don't know, is that right before we get to the part about the shining city on the hill, there is the famous reminder that God gave Saul a commission to utterly destroy the Amalekites. And when God gives a special commission, he looks to have it strictly observed in every article. And Winthrop reminded his fellow shipmates that when Saul did not do this, it lost him the kingdom that should have been his reward. And the Puritans came to their new Canaan knowing that they would have to take it from the new Amalekites. Relative peace lasted for only 17 years after the English arrived, and then the Pequot War broke out. Now, what were the Mass Bay and the Plymouth colonists doing down here, down south? And I will give you a clue, and it is, consider the Quahog. By the standards of the time, Massachusetts was like a super disappointing territory. Many of you may think it still is. There were no gold or silver mines. There was no great river heading leading inland into beaver country. Now remember, back in the way back, those hats, the pilgrim hats, the admiral's hats, the tricorn hats, all of those hats relied on beaver fur. Because beaver fur has this property of holding its shape and standing up to wet weather. So, you know, you can't imagine a naval admiral, you know, with his hat, if it were to droop. So that was why they really needed beavers. But there was no great river leading into beaver country. And the farmers and tradesmen who made up the bulk of the colonists, they didn't have the skills to create a big salt cod fishery and trade for Spain. So the Massachusetts colonists had learned from the Dutch about the Haudenosaunee up north and about their demand for wampum beads. Now, wampum was not money. It was the stuff of the social contract. It was the means to document a covenantal relationship with self and other in which the creator was always deemed to be a third party. And there was a sacredness about wampum which gave it a material value for the Haudenosaunee above any European trade goods. So, no, wampum was not money, but to European money, it was a means of exchange that sure looked like money. And, you know, what they really, really believed and were confused. And in fact, the Western scientific name, does anyone know it for the quahog? We have any? It's Mercenaria mercenaria is the scientific name of the quahog. So at the time, the quahog fishery was controlled by the natives of Long Island Sound, the Narragansett, whose base is right around here, and the Pequot, the Niantic, and the Mohegan. Now, the Dutch, with trade goods, including iron anvils and weapons, oh boy, the Dutch encouraged these folks to produce more wampum. Then, by 1630, the Mass Bay colonists arrived. Wampum had been pretty effectively, unofficially monetized throughout New England as the key to the fur trade. It was all about those hats. You know, you think people today are obsessed by shoes. Back then, it was hats. And now, the Massachusetts Bay Colony had a different problem. They were also strapped for cash. Because it wasn't a rich resource area, the only way for the colonists to raise coin was to sell produce to the next wave of colonists. And that was kind of like a Ponzi scheme that didn't work. What they really needed was a circulating currency, because barter was very complex and cumbersome. So the Puritans needed a circulating currency, and wampum was deemed to be the answer. So meanwhile, the growing value of wampum had already led to violent conflicts between the Narragansett and the Pequot. And there were some terrible skirmishes in which people were killed, and then Massachusetts, the folks from Boston got involved to try to sort this out in a way that they would get the wampum. And what happened was misunderstandings and the sense that there was either a deal or no deal, depending on whether or not you understood wampum as money or as sacred. The fact was the Narragansetts and the Pequots did not understand that the people from Massachusetts had access to their territories, and they began to resist. And if you're interested in the history, there is a terrific new book, came out in 2019, called The City-State of Boston. And it's by Mark Peterson of Yale. And he describes this descending spiral of violence that culminated in the decision by Massachusetts to punish the Pequots. And this led to the Pequot Massacre of 1637. How many people, does anyone know about the Pequot Massacre? A couple folks do. So listen to the description from Plymouth Governor William Bradford. He writes, "Those that escaped the fire were slain with the sword, some hewed to pieces, others run through with rapiers, so they were thus destroyed about 400 at this time. It was a fearful sight to see them thus frying in the fire, and streams of blood quenching the same, and horrible was the stink and scent thereof, but the victory seemed like a sweet sacrifice, and they gave their prayers to God, who had wrought so wonderfully for them, thus to enclose their enemies in their hands." It was an ambush at night, everyone was sleeping, "and give them so speedy a victory over so proud and insulting an enemy." And, you know, personally, I find this theologically pretty astounding. You know, the importance of a sacrifice's aroma is not what it smells like, but what the aroma represents. And in many traditions, it's substitutionary atonement. But for William Bradford, it appears to have been the justification for the first act of genocide as a sacrifice to their god. And, you know, I personally think that's pretty incredible. Certainly flies in the face of our first principle. But what, at the time, it was business was in full. In that same year, shortly thereafter, the officials in Boston declared wampum to be legal tender, and that's not all. They took the surviving Pequots and rounded them up and sold them down south to the Caribbean to work on the sugar plantations. Yes, so back up in Haudenosaunee country, they took this, you know, with under advisement. When the Mohawk negotiated their own covenant with Great Britain, this was in 1677, they were a little bit more specific, let's put it that way. The idea of the ship and the canoe in parallel was the same, but the visual emphasis was different. That two-row belt that I told you about, that was like looking down from the top at the bands running this way. This time, it was a frontal view with on one side a Haudenosaunee and on another side a British person. And between them, the biggest visual image in the belt is the covenant chain. And that is, I think for us, a very good reminder as we go forward into 2020. Because you all are the hosts of General Assembly 2020. And I think that's a blessing. So let's review, like, I think that two important things will be happening kind of at the same time. One of them is the unofficial agenda, and the other one is the official agenda. And as I'm sure you know, the Reverend Susan Frederick Gray is determined, and as are many of us, to stamp out white supremacy within the Unitarian Universalist Association. And that is not something that has been greeted with open arms by everyone. And there was a little bit of shenanigans about that at the last General Assembly. And so I'm just wondering, like, what kind of interpersonal shenanigans might show up at GA 2020? So, what I, in the spirit of this sermon, I considered the Quahog, and I have come up with the following hypothesis. And you know, living in Massachusetts, I have firm views on chowder. Can you imagine some UUs telling other UUs that white chowder is the right chowder, and that anyone else's taste in chowder is deluded or illogical? Now, I think that would be, and I'm giving a, you know, this is a joke, it's a metaphor, but this is the kind of thing that can happen. There are not too many people of color here today, but at GA there are hundreds, and we don't want to be, in my opinion, one of those congregations who afterwards says, well, who were these people who were offended? You know, they're people like me. So go gently. And The second thing that I wanted to talk about is the theme of General Assembly. How many people have seen and are aware of the GA 2020 theme? All right, well then I won't feel shy about reading it out. A major focus of General Assembly 2020 will be partnership with Indigenous leaders in the Northeast to explore how to coexist with one another and the land we occupy. So, how do we act in solidarity with Indigenous communities? This is going to be one of the major themes of discussion. So, to this, I will throw out that the lead minister in my home congregation, the Reverend Adam Lawrence Dyer, has suggested atonement by the UUs, the UCCs, and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and I personally would add Harvard, all of whom are the theological descendants of our Mass Bay and Plymouth colony. However, in Massachusetts, we have a thriving urban Indian intertribal community who has put together an Indigenous legislative agenda that calls for a statewide Indigenous Peoples Day, prohibiting the use of Native team sports names and mascots, redesigning our state flag and seal, which you may have seen is... I'll just leave it there. Supporting Native education and protecting Native heritage. Now, in my spiritual home of Hawaii, the Kia'i, or protectors of Mauna Kea, are demanding respect for Kanaka Maoli spirituality. Like 200 years of being swept under the rug is, you know, it's stopping right now. And respect for their sacred places. They are reminding us that the Hawaiian kingdom was never extinguished and lit. Later on this morning, Al will be singing a protest song from 1893 that we're still singing today. And for that matter, the United States never got permission to annex Hawaii. Can you imagine if Roxanne and I decided to take over your house? That's kind of how it went down. So, meanwhile, here on Rhode Island, the Narragansett people are still here. And the Pokanoket people are struggling for recognition. As we go into the 2020 prep season, where else could we look for inspiration? And once again, I invite you to consider the Quahog. Like, you may or may not know that all 13 of the original colonies have a treaty with the Haudenosaunee. And how has it expired? No. It lasts for as long as the sun shines, the grass grows, and water runs downhill. Now, how this happened was Seneca leader Red Jacket had warned George Washington about rusty places on the chain of friendship between the Haudenosaunee and the United States. Now, the name, the pet name that the Haudenosaunee had for George Washington was something that translated into town destroyer. So in 1794, Washington dispatched his postmaster general, Timothy Pickering, to renew peace. And the resulting Kandayuga Treaty affirmed the nation's right to their land and established peace and friendship between them and the United States. To commemorate this, there is a 6-foot-long wampum belt showing 13 figures representing each for one of the original colonies, including Rhode Island, linking arms with figures showing the Haudenosaunee nations. Today, Haudenosaunee country is full of scholars and elders interpreting the applicability of wampum belts to today's world. Native people find it more and more difficult to stay entirely in the canoe, as the belts advise. The world of the ship is all around us. Those raised to pass into the world of the ship suffer spiritually from individuality and patriarchy. This is why it is important for us to enter into relations with intertribal organizations that serve the 80% of Native Americans who live in cities. And I happen to know that there is one such organization at Brown and that you can walk to it from here. The late Dr. Bob Antone, who's a member of the Oneida Nation's Traditional Chiefs Council, saw it this way: together, we have to attend to the river, Like, it's no longer enough to say, we're going to be here in our ship, and they, whoever they are, can be over there in their canoe. That is not working. It's not working spiritually for either one of us. Speaking at a conference at Six Nations Polytechnic College in 2016, he made it clear that so-called polishing the chain of covenant includes a requirement to look at the overall spiritual and physical environment within which the relationship exists. Now, those are two ideas for connecting. Our treaties, he said, are teaching about kindness and inclusion. The two-row is about building and maintaining relationship. Well, the grass is still growing and the water is still running downhill, and we in Massachusetts have not done our part, and I don't think you in Rhode Island have either. Fortunately, in this building, we are Unitarian Universalists, and we do know something about getting back in covenant. That is a skill and a competence that we have. And I think we can do this. So let us all go forward to General Assembly 2020 with what our Haudenosaunee treaty partners would call a good mind, free of entitlement and knowing that we don't have all the answers. May respect and friendship be kindled through learning and listening, starting with our common read. And may we approach the challenge of atonement with clear eyes, open ears, and peaceful intentions in our hearts. And I hope that you will make it so.